part of our music history of today, and always try to bring you the best in music and the best in conversation. And we have with us in the studio to continue this conversation, there was a blog post that was put up called You're Breaking My Heart. Baltimore City, You're Breaking My Heart. It caused a huge controversy. It was tweeted all over the place. It was all over Facebook. People commenting on it from different points of view. One of our guests, Adam Jackson, had a pretty pointed commentary on the piece on Facebook. And so we're going to talk about that in the context. We'll give you some pieces that were in there. We'll reflect on what Commissioner Batts said. You'll go to our callers who didn't get to Commissioner Batts to join in on this part of our conversation. We're joined in the studio by Adam Jackson, who is CEO of Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle. Tim Barnett is founder of the Baltimore Bike Party, author of a response to the aforementioned article called Baltimore City, You're Not Breaking My Heart, I'm Not Leaving. Katie Long is program director and Hispanic liaison with the Friends of Patterson Park. She joins us in studio as well. And Haste Westbrook, right? A partner in Changing Media, a digital agency devoted to social change, author of the blog post To Save, Be More, Embrace the Wire. And Dr. Tara Bynum is with us. She is assistant professor in the Department of English at Taos University. And Dr. Tara Bynum, welcome. Good to have you all with us here.
Thank you.
410-319-8888 is the number here. Write to us at steinershow@gmail.com. You can log on to our Facebook pages. Tweet me at Mark Steiner. We've had a lot of tweets this morning, so continue tweeting. And we'd love to have your thoughts here in the airwaves. So when I read this piece, and we did ask her to come on, she was going to come on, then she decided she did not want to come on, and she may come on later. Which is fine, I understand. I think she's a little gun-shy after all the battering back and forth, and I can respect that. But what this piece did was, in some ways, in the conversation we had with Commissioner Batts, is talk about the deep frustration I think people in Baltimore have around the question of crime and what's happening in our city and what happens. You know, I was listening to the mayor's speech, and she talked about now, you know, we're going to the 24/7 watch. We talk about David Kennedy coming to town with a different approach to crime fighting. She talked about the center she wants to set up for kids will be taken off the street who violate curfew. And so this is people are trying to grasp at this thing. So I wonder what it was about the blog in the first place that really set people off. Why do you think it set people off so deeply when she talked about how sick she was of crime and that she thought people should have she was calling for more people to be arrested for minor crimes and saying she wanted a decent place to live in the city and it was that we need a sense of community. So what was it about what she wrote that you think got people, Katie?
I think pulling out just a couple of things that she said about like the property taxes comment and you know that she pays some of the highest property taxes in the state, I guess, and then or in the city, and then also what she said about more police. And I think I will say that one thing that was clear about her piece is how much she loves her community and how much she wants to keep on loving it. Yeah,
right.
Which is great. But I think you know when you hear comments about needing more police and more arrests, I feel like it can potentially drive a wedge even you know harder between communities. And I think now is the time, you know, as tempting as it is to kind of shut yourselves in and get more police on the street, which you know is appreciated in some ways, I think now's the time to get out and engage with each other and you know I represent Patterson Park, so and play with each other and get to know each other more, as tempting as it is to shut yourself in. I think that's the important part. So I think yeah, there were some conflicting things.
I think that's what we want to try to get to. You wrote a piece, Tim, as well, right, in response to this?
Yes. I mean, I wrote a piece after reading what she had written, really on my lunch break, something that I thought was just going to sort of circle around amongst my friends. It wasn't really meant to be what it became, which I'm sure Tracy has the same sentiments. But I know that what resonated for me and what was echoed by many people I knew and ultimately many people I didn't know was that it's completely legitimate to have these fears and these concerns. And these are things that are very real to the people in that neighborhood right now. But I felt that, and this is not a reflection of her as a person, but as that piece seem to have a lack of reflection on the fact that this is an everyday life for decades for many people in America, and to only become outraged when it has come to your doorstep, I feel it's not the kind of love that I have for my city. You know, the value of someone's life is not contingent upon their proximity to my doorstep. And that was sort of the tone that I got from her that was a little, you know, it just got to me that it was, you know, I understand that there's these horrific murders and attacks that have happened in this neighborhood, but that's not the only thing that's been happening. And there are a lot of really, really deep issues in this city that need to be solved by things more than police.
Tara, you have not been with us before, so let me turn to you and get your thoughts. I'm going to turn to Adam Jackson, okay?
I think what struck me about the essay, in part, is that it uses our kind of colorblind language to talk about things that are deeply racialized in cities across America and in Baltimore in particular. So on the one hand, we have these very real everyday concerns that impact everybody. But when you talk about race and crime, or when you talk about crime, you're ultimately having a conversation about race, even if you use language like safe neighborhood, nice neighborhood. Those words ultimately mean something. And I think what the piece does is kind of indirectly ask us to confront matters of race locally and nationally, of course.
Madam, you wrote a pretty scathing piece in Facebook, as I recall.
Yeah.
Which one of the reasons we called you.
Yeah, the piece actually made me pretty upset.
I could see that.
The piece is, what I would call it is white selective moral outrage. You know, it's one of those things where I read the piece and I was trying to get the message. I understood the message of wanting crime to decrease. Everyone wants crime to decrease everywhere. That's a pretty global sentiment, and that's why I think people shared it initially, including, like, people of all colors or whatever. But if you look at the examples she gives of places, the crimes that were committed that she was extremely displeased with, the place where she lived, which was around Patterson Park, and then the neighborhoods that she was concerned about, it wasn't black most of the time. Most of the time it wasn't lower-class black folks who live in West Baltimore. I mean, I grew up in Northwest Baltimore, and the area I lived in was pretty nice, but I've always seen crime. And now it's like this white woman gets on the internet and writes an article that apparently she didn't expect to go viral. And now it's the concern. Now we have the commissioner talking about this article. When black people that live in lower class neighborhoods around Baltimore every day deal with crime on massive scales. It doesn't have to be murders necessarily. People see crime every day. Black people are oppressed in this city and are done violence to every day in Baltimore. So when white people start talking about in my paradise in Canton, someone was robbed and now it's an issue. It doesn't strike me because it's like, yeah, people are robbed every day in West Baltimore. People are robbed every day in Westport. People are robbed every day in East Baltimore. So why is this a huge issue now? Because white people have decided that in their neighborhoods, you know, now it's spilled out to the streets. And even in the article itself, the language uses like real racialized subterfuge aimed at black people. Like, if these people would just leave, then we would be okay. And I think that's the part we're not discussing, is that colorblind language that Dr. Bynum's talking about is used throughout the article. And to not mention race is really, it does a disservice to our conversation on race and crime.
Hassan, let me bring you in here. You also had a blog post to say Baltimore embraced the wire.
Sure. I mean, I agree to a certain extent with Tim that I understand where she's coming from. I understand the fear and her fatigue. She says she's tired. But in many ways, I think what the viewpoint she represented touched on a lot of what I was getting at, in that I think that there's a knee-jerk reaction to something as obvious as crime. But the response seems to be to want to wish certain people away as though they could be made to disappear. It's almost like a white middle-class ghost dance could be done, and then people could simply disappear. And that's an impossibility. It's a practical impossibility, as well as an unethical position to take. So I think the short-sightedness of that bothered me, disturbed me quite deeply.
Now, I want to get to the phones here, the issue of the city and what's going on in the city is a very deep one and on a lot of levels. And I think that I was thinking about some of the crimes that were written about and alluded to in the blog post. And I knew some of the people who were, some reporter was beaten with a brick in the street, and there are kind of beat downs in poor neighborhoods in the city all the time that are gang related and other related, and crimes are going on. People are robbed. The little girl who was robbed, and she was 12 years old. I mean, that happens a lot in the streets with people who are going after kids, and that happens. That doesn't make the press very much when it's, you know, on Fulton Avenue, or if it's down in the heart of East Baltimore. If you don't hear about those things, or they happen all the time. But there's also, I think, some, and I'm just curious what you think about this and how you address some of this. So some of this stuff, because the city has always been kind of divided racially. Even people of goodwill and faith, you know, live in different places from one another and party in different places from one another and go to theater in different places from one another. And that's just a sad reality, and maybe that can be changed. But I wonder how you think that plays into it in terms of the maybe there's part of the subtext of this we never talk about is this is not justifying anything. The subtext to it is the rage that happens sometimes from people completely dislocated going into other places. So I'm saying that there's a lot here that I think that gives us maybe a moment to figure out a way to begin to build a bridge. If we can kind of just address the real reality of what we're seeing in our city. Is that possible?
I mean, I feel it's possible. I think that, and it's not what I'm here to talk about in general, but it is tied to this conversation, that in the founding of Bike Party, for those who are not familiar, it's basically a giant bike ride that's like a parade through the city every month. And very early on, one of the goals was to cross those neighborhood boundaries and to break down those barriers and to take people into places that they would not normally go into. And while it's a very superficial way of making those introductions, it certainly does not build relationships. But you're right that we exist in this city where people say, oh, I don't go across that street because I'll get murdered, or, oh, I don't go across this street because everybody's going to look at me the wrong way. And I think we need to move out of this idea of us being a series of isolated neighborhoods and get back to being a city as a whole and embracing everybody in it and interacting with everybody in the city. You know, I think that the solution to this problem, I shouldn't say the solution because there is no one solution, but I think paramount to it is building those relationships with other people have alluded to, that when we, you know, when we get to know everybody in our city, that changes the way that we view it. Instead of just knowing our neighbors, branching out into the city as a whole.
You'll hear about it, then we'll go to Adam. What were you going to say?
No, I was just going to say that I do wish I was like more articulate in talking with race and class politics. I'm so glad we're talking about this. But I was going to share kind of like Tim was sharing. The Friends of Patterson Parker, I had the privilege of being involved in a group called Community for All Ages that happens in Southeast Baltimore. And the whole mission was to the whole idea is that a community that is healthy and happy is a community that trusts each other. And I think that's one thing that came from the fear in response to these crimes is like we don't trust each other maybe. So anyway, the Community for All Ages worked together to bring people of all ages, races, ethnicities, language backgrounds together to plan events together and to be around the table together and then, you know, have fun together in those events. And the other day after this murder was on the news and these two young black kids' faces were all over the news, I was walking home from the park up Eastern Avenue and I saw kind of two blocks away from me, some like 16-year-olds, African-American boys outside of a shop. And I will say just my immediate shameful reaction was to kind of take a breath and be like, okay, what, I'm going to walk up. And I knew him. His name was Devon. And I smiled at him and he smiled at me and I said, hey, how's it going? And he's like, good. And I was like, oh my gosh, I'm so glad I haven't seen you in a while. And it just occurred to me, like, this kid was part of Community for All Ages. And I had sat around a table with him and I helped plan the art cart derby and the Halloween parade. And it worked. You know, it worked for me, and maybe it's not working for a lot of people, but I just wish there was more of that.
So I do want to get to the phones here, but let me bring Tara, because I know, Tara, you have to leave in like 10 minutes, so I want to get you in this conversation and go back to Adam. Go ahead, Tara.
You know, I was thinking about this idea of Baltimore as a whole city instead of a collection of neighborhoods, and I've been here my whole life. And what I do think is interesting about the way that crime is shaped is that there are neighborhoods that I don't go into because I know that there's a legacy of white violence against black people. And Patterson Park is one of them. Mm-hmm. Highland Town is another. Canton is a little bit better because it's so commercialized, but Canton used to be on that list. Bell's Point, Federal Hill, Hamden. Mm-hmm. So I also think that as we are imagining who the criminals are,
right,
and who the threat is, we also have to understand our own identities in that process. And thinking about kind of the what one person's perspective of safety is and how that's threatened, I think we have to include in that conversation that, you know, despite the changes that have happened throughout the neighborhoods that I've mentioned, I still remember a time when to be a black woman in those spaces with, you know, my black father and other people was a life-threatening exercise. And, you know, though I'm aging every year, I'm not that old. So, we're talking about the 90s.
Right.
We're talking about the recent past. And I also think that, you know, as we put this in the context of the essay, part of what we are observing is a neighborhood tension that has been, that's historical and embedded into the history of a space like Patterson Park and its neighboring communities.
It's an interesting point. I think that's real. And Adam, we're being able to get to the phones here and make sure that our callers kind of help generate some of the rest of this conversation. They're calling from all over the city, so I want to get these different ideas in. I can remember stories my father used to tell growing up Jewish in East Baltimore many, many eons ago. He wouldn't go to Canton because you had to fight, because the Polish and Ukrainian kids would beat up any Jew that walked through the neighborhood. Or if you were black or Jewish, you didn't cross Green Spring Avenue in Baltimore, in my generation, because then you had to be ready to knock with the kids from Handen because they hated Jews and they hated black folks. If you crossed that block, you were going to have to throw your hands up, with no question about it. I mean, that's the reality. That this has always been a separate city. It's never been a city that's come. It's always been that way for as long as I can remember.
Yeah, I wanted to address your question. I mean, I don't think you can have peace in an unjust society, and I don't think you can build a bridge unless you invest in communities that have traditionally, you know, those people have been screwed over. And I'll give you an example. I mean, I was 23 years old, and that was the first time I went to Canton because I was in the mayoral fellowship program, and I had never been there, I'd never walked there, never took the bus there, and I had to go there for a meeting. And I went to the building, and I got out, and I looked around. I was like, what is this place? Like, where am I at? I walked down the street. I immediately felt uncomfortable. I was like, I don't know where I am. I called my friend, and I was like, man, I'm in a foreign country. I don't know where this place is. And so I was thinking about it, and I was like, I grew up in a working-class neighborhood. My parents were working class. You know, all of our neighbors. I grew up in a very good—
What neighborhood did you grow up in?
I grew up in, Hanlon Park.
Hanlon Park.
So, I felt like I grew up in a working-class black neighborhood, and I should be pretty used to those kinds of environments. But then when I walk around the corner, I go down Garrison Boulevard. I went to Walbrook and Garrison Middle School, and you wouldn't see that same investment. And I was thinking, like, okay, well, when you talk about crime in a vacuum, like this article had attempted to do, like, yeah, we just need to get more police, we need to arrest more people, and that'll solve the issue. When most of the murders in Baltimore, they don't happen because of organized crime. They happen because of domestic issues. And the data doesn't speak to, you know, a highly organized group of folks trying to kill folks. It's because people are suffering in Baltimore, mostly black people. And that, to me, that's the issue. That's the conversation we need to be having, is we need to have an honest conversation in Baltimore City about race and how it affects our ability to give people a quality life, how it affects our ability to give them jobs, how the political infrastructure impairs their ability to make Baltimore a better place to live. And I think that's the conversation we're not having, because the people who have the power and the resources are making that conversation, you know, inept.
Let me tell the folks who are waiting on the phone, this is where we're going to go, and folks, do not hang up. We're going to go to Thomas and Canton. We're going to go to Bob, Will, and Travis in that order. So hold on. You're all going to get on the air here. We're going to hear your thoughts. But we haven't heard from Hasdy in a moment. Because I think one of the things I thought about, what you were saying and what you all were saying, is that maybe part of that dialogue, that conversation about what we how we have to push Baltimore forward has to take place like this. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I'm saying? I mean, bringing people who don't know each other from across this city to begin to have the conversation, not necessarily to do the bridge to nowhere, but to build something in the city that actually can make some change. I mean, that is, to me, what the only way to get this done.
I agree. I think there's an opportunity for dialogue, and I think as much as some of us might be angered by the way that Trace Alveson expressed this point of view, it has opened up this discussion. I think one thing that's really important to think about in that context is that much of this thing that we all said it blew up on social media, online, and so forth, much of that was discussion between people privileged enough to have access to those forums. Exactly. And I think Dee Watkins was on the show yesterday, had a brilliant piece about access to sort of the mediums and the media that allow us to have this conversation. And I think, to Adam's point, we can't have this conversation without the people who were made to be the other in this conversation. And we kept having this conversation online between each other and with all this outrage. And yet those people who are essentially the subject of it and also the protagonists in it were not included in that conversation. And we need to find ways to make them part of it.
I think Dee Watkins is going to be one of those voices we're going to hear more from. The piece he wrote, he was really wonderful on the show yesterday. Do we have time to get a quick call in here? 410-319-8888. Let's go to Thomas in Canton. You're on the air.
Hey, how you doing this morning, Mark?
Very well, Thomas. Welcome.
I'm sitting home, actually, right now, and I'm a little disheartened about the conversation and the direction that it's gone. I think that a lot of Baltimore, particularly the people that have had a very negative outlook on this article, are misconstruing the point that was trying to be made here. I think that when we go and we make it about the us versus them conversation, it kind of defeats that whole goal that we all have. Here's a woman who has her reality and has the things that she knows and is discussing a point that's very real to her. And to say something like, well, when it's happening to us over here, you know, you weren't saying anything, is kind of pointless. I think that if we look at the way that she went about things, and waited a lot of my neighbors and myself in particular have gone into going about speaking to our councilmen and speaking to our reps and having these community meetings and pushing for the things that we all want as neighbors, that's a model that I think everyone should embrace, let alone, I think it's just counterproductive, you know, because the reason that the article, I think, caught fire is because it was real. It was the truth. And everybody has that feeling, no matter where you're from, that there's not enough being done from the top down, that a lot of the decisions that are being made are being detrimental to the ultimate goal, and that's to have a safe Baltimore for everyone.
You know, who wants to grab that real first before we go to break? Anybody want to jump in? You're about to leave here, so let me let you have a first thought.
It is true that everyone wants a safe Baltimore, but I think it's also true that in order to get to a safe Baltimore, we have to have a real conversation about the many different issues around race inequality that inform matters of crime. Like, I think we need to be honest with ourselves about that realness and that reality.
I think that in some ways that the caller is dead on, that one of the other things that really resonated with me and bothered me about the piece that Tracy wrote was that it was pointing out the problem without providing solutions, and that there are solutions that are already happening all over this city. And it sounds like that this caller and people he knows are already very involved in trying to make a better Baltimore. Mm-hmm. And to me, that's really what needs to happen. I agree with him that these are things that need to happen on all levels. And I think that, you know, it's certainly not my place to sit here and talk about what it's like to be black in Baltimore. But I think that for Baltimore to improve, that race is definitely part of the problem, and that we as, like me as a middle-class white person, also have to understand my own privilege and what I need to do for myself to make Baltimore a better place. And that tone that the caller alluded to, of this us versus them that was in that article, was very disconcerting to me. It, you know, it hurt me because it had this idea that there's some people that are the problem and there's some people that are not the problem. When in one way or another, no matter how small or how big, all of us are a part of this problem. That, you know, we all have some blood on our hands in the interactions and the decisions that we make every day that lead to the fact that this violence continues to be here. You know, I received some flack for my comment and my piece about mourning the loss of Kim Lito, but not mourning the lives of the two young men that took her life. But I stand adamantly by that point that, you know, I don't know these two boys, but I know that we as a city shaped who they are and what brought them to that point. And to somehow say that, like, they are the problem and not we all, black, white, rich, poor, are part of this problem and need to be striving to be a part of the solution, I think that's what needs to happen.
We have to take a very brief break. We'll come right back. And I want to thank Dr. Tara Bynum for joining us for this part of the program. Great to have you in the studio. We look forward to having you back.
Yeah, thanks.
Don't worry, we're going to come back more of this conversation, joined by Bobby Marvin Holmes, coming in to be our next guest as well to join this panel. Stay with us. We'll be right back. UB Blake. Now tell me that's not classical music. The man was amazing. Today he passed away, and of course that was one of our moments in Baltimore black history. We continue this conversation here and there, reminding you on the way there, the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by the Maryland State Education Association, from school funding to Common Core. You can learn about the important issues affecting Maryland students, parents, and schools by visiting the Maryland State Education Association's website at marylandeducators.org. That's one word, marylandeducators.org, or log on to steinershow.org. and click on the Maryland State Education Association's banner on our website as one of our underwriters. We're here with Adam Jackson, CEO of Leaders with a Beautiful Struggle, Tim Barnett, founder of the Baltimore Bike Party, author of the response to the aforementioned article we talked about, Baltimore City, You're Not Breaking My Heart, I'm Not Leaving. Katie Long is program director and Hispanic liaison of the Friends of Patterson Park and a resident of Patterson Park, Brewers Hill. Right?
Mm, yep. Right,
yeah, right? Yeah. Jose Westbrook, who is a partner in Changing Media, a digital agency devoted to social change. He also wrote a blog post called To Save, Be More, Embrace the Wire. And our newest guest now is Bobby Marvin Holmes, youth advocate, Baltimore Youth Advocate Programs, program committed to helping adjudicated young people in our community, producer of an incredible documentary called Live Young Blood, a documentary focused on the struggle to end youth violence in our community. And Bobby Marvin Holmes, of course, you know that name because he was a producer on the Mark Steiner Show for a long time before he decided to figure out how to get to graduate school and left. Good to have you all here. 410-319-8888 is the number. You can write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Tweet us at Mark Steiner. Log on to our Facebook pages. And on the way to the phones, Hasdey, you were going to say what?
Yes, just briefly. I mean, I think that Tracy Halverson's perspective shouldn't be condemned out of hand. I think it's valuable that she expressed it, and I realize that it resonates. I mean, it resonates with me. I've been the victim of crime in Baltimore. I've been carjacked. I think, though, that speaking about us versus them, I think there was this troubling undercurrent of us versus them thinking of that mentality in what she wrote, of a kind of makers versus takers or makers versus breakers mentality. And I think that's fundamentally counterproductive. And I recall that she listed some of the great things about Baltimore, and it was a list of restaurants. I'm sure they're very nice restaurants. And and there were some businesses in there that I would describe as sort of yuppie businesses, and there's absolutely nothing wrong with yuppie businesses. We need those things as well. But to me, you know, what's also great about Baltimore are the people who are struggling, you know, grappling with the darkness on the front lines of social change. That's what makes Baltimore great as well. People who are, whether it be needle exchange or gang intervention or the work that some of our guests here are doing, I think that needs to be recognized as part of Baltimore's true greatness.
Let me go right to the phones, if I might, again, get folks back in. 410-319-8888. Will, you've been waiting for a long time. You're on the air.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Thanks for holding on.
All right. Now, at one point, let's say what we call Black America is 40% or more of the population. We're a majority of the labor force, skilled or whatnot. Then we have this time period where you have emancipation. And then we had imported a huge number of Europeans that migrated across Europe, across the ocean. So my point is this. What was the motivation for Europeans to come over to the United States? Or what was the marketing tool you used? Because it wasn't to say, hey, we're going to help these people that were disenfranchised, we're going to help these people that went through this struggle. It was more so to participate in a caste system. Also, I'd like to add, for the police, why not make them get a bachelor's degree, make them pay for their education with the classes that they enroll in, to go towards the community. At least they'll have some history, and maybe they'll honor the Africans of America that's been here, and especially the resources that we've contributed to this nation. Thank you.
All right, well, thank you. We'll go back to the history part another day. I'm not quite sure how to respond to that completely, but in terms of what we're looking at here in Baltimore now. But so let me, before we go to Travis in Highland Town, hold on, we're going to come to your call here. 410-319-8888 is the number. But just extrapolating out a bit from what he said, this is Baltimore's the city that has been is one of these Upper South cities. Mm-hmm. It's north and it's south, right? It was a city that was a slave state. So it's got that deep southern quality to it, always has. It was a state that always had a huge black population, always had, in the 19th century, had the largest free black population in the United States of America before the Civil War. It's always had this powerful black middle class in the city forever. It's a city that brought in people from across the globe because we were the second largest port of entry, which this Will was alluding to, that my father's family came through. Instead of going to New York, they came to Baltimore, which is why you have so many Jews and Greeks and Italians and everybody else who ended up in this city. Now Latinos are growing in this town. I mean, this has always been a city that's been mixed that way. So it's got south and it's got north and it's got south, but we've always been in our own little worlds. And so, Bobby, let me bring you in here since you're welcome. I'm glad you're a guest on the show here. Good to have you here.
Thanks for having me, Mark.
So you heard the first half an hour of this?
Yes.
Tell me the thoughts.
I really think Tracy's article definitely pointed out the huge wedge that we have here in Baltimore and how segregated Baltimore is, not just on racial lines but class lines as well. You know, Mark, we had several conversations about this, how different our communities are, yet they're so close together. And I think Tracy's article really highlighted that point on how different we are, but more so pointed to the need on why we have to connect with one another as neighbors. And just having this conversation alone, Mark, have different folks from different parts of Baltimore to come together and never met each other and probably don't on a daily basis communicate with folks from that particular neighborhood to come together to have a conversation about crime and the social change that's happening and how to continue to transform Baltimore. But it all starts with the conversation, of course. But Tracy also pointed out to the need for more folks to get involved. There was a lot of finger-pointing in the article and a lot of blaming that was going on and laying the blame at the foot of other folks and not understanding that the transformation of Baltimore requires for all of us to take responsibility. Doesn't matter whether you're the librarian or the sanitation worker or the mayor or the police officer or the teacher. It requires for all of Baltimore to take responsibility. Honestly, paying taxes is not enough. Living in the city, say I'm excited to live here as opposed to living in Prince George's or Howard County, it's not enough. But actually get involved with your community and going a step further by reaching out to other community associations and other folks who are involved and who are concerned about change in Baltimore. But it does a disservice if we just sit around and blame people. So today, this conversation and thereafter is opportunities for us to connect with one another, because that's what it's going to take for us to build that bridge within a city that really these communities only maybe 15, 20, 25 minutes apart in an environment. I mean, especially when you look at Patterson Park and where it is. Yeah, it's a very mixed community. And blocks away, you have McGallery Park, where two of my boys that I work with, they live there, where you have low poverty people, you have people that sell drugs, but you also have working, hard-working, law-abiding people only a few blocks away from Patterson Park that love their city and try to change their city. I think about named people such as Glenn Ross. I think about people such as Todd Carter, who is blocks away, who are working to make a difference in that community. They are upstanding citizens that you can connect with and build relationships with. But to look down on and to point fingers is a disservice, and it's very unfortunate.
Okay, let me bring you back in before we go back to the phones, because there's a lot you said I kind of want to reflect on. I want to spend a minute reflecting on something the mayor said in her State of the City speech to get your reflections on some of her responses to what we're facing. But yes, at Patterson Park, denizen of Patterson Park, how do you respond to it, what Bobby was talking about?
Yeah, I mean, I think just the same thing. Like, I think now more than ever is the time to, like, get out, volunteer, like, older people need to get to know younger people. Younger people need to get to know older people. And like what I think Adam and Tara was saying about Patterson Park being one of those communities that you've traditionally been afraid to come to, like, that's what breaks my heart. So what I try to do, or, like, you know, as a program director of the Friends, and like what I think a lot of other organizations in the area try to do, is create this free programming that's accessible to everybody. And we do have a total mixed income. You know, I'm the Hispanic liaison, so we do a lot of outreach with the Latino community, and we see, and that's one of, I think even Tracy cited in her article, that's one of the things that people love about that area, that it is diverse. But what I'm hearing is that we need to do, like, a better job. And I think, yeah, I'm hoping that, you know, conversations like this will get people to know different neighborhoods and know, and that community isn't seen as just for, you know, upwardly mobile people, that it's seen for everybody. And I'm also open to suggestions on how to do that better. We like to think that we do that, but we want to do it better.
Yeah, I just want to, I mean, I don't disagree with either one of you, because I do think to a large degree, people in Baltimore from different communities need to be involved on the daily basis, because I feel like I am. I feel like people should be more in Baltimore. Right, and I would take it a step further, though, because the thing is, the issues we're talking about, like crime, or you could talk about education, you could talk about a bunch of issues in Baltimore, poverty, that are structural issues, that are societal issues. And to me, if we're going to talk about driving down things that impair our ability to live quality lives, we've got to have not just hard conversations, but we have to have marching orders on how to move forward. And I think, I mean, in my perspective, is that you have to take direction from, like, people that, like you said, Bobby, people that are in the community, like people in the grassroots. Because I think sometimes in Baltimore, what we do is we take advice from transplants, from external organizations, from external people. We try to apply it to a place that it really doesn't make sense to, like Baltimore. And then it doesn't work out, and then we wonder what happened, and then we have to start all over again. And one of the most frustrating things is that, you know, the political infrastructure in the city does not take cues from the people. It takes cues from people who aren't here, that have money here, that have political interests here, but don't have real stake in the city in the long term. And to me, that's the most frustrating thing about conversations like these, because we're in Baltimore, we're really good at talking. We're really good at having forums. We're really good at having panels. We're really good at, you know, talking about stuff in the abstract. But when it comes down, when the rubber hits the road, when you talk about, like, resources to solve these issues, when you're talking about how people move forward in the city to drive down stuff like crime, it never goes to people who are in the grassroots. It goes to people who are external to the communities. And to me, that's what drives up all these issues of crime and poverty.
What do you mean by external to the communities? What does that mean?
I mean, a good example, people in, like, the people that we hire to work here in Baltimore that are in the highest levels of public policy, the highest level of like public policy of decision makers, they aren't from Baltimore. They go to Hopkins, they go to large universities in the area, but they aren't from here. And so they try to apply their college book knowledge to these communities where it really doesn't make sense. To me, it makes more sense to get to give resources and information to a mother who runs a program for pregnant teen mothers, as opposed to, you know, a white girl that went to Hopkins and try to get like funnel stuff into her program, because that doesn't make sense to me. People that are indigenous to the community should be controlling the programs that come in their community. And to me, that's the hard conversation, because those structural and societal issues aren't addressed in Baltimore because we aren't honest about how we distribute those kinds of resources. So to me, you can't address crime if you don't start there. If you don't start with the grassroots and the people in the community.
Do you have any comment on that, anybody? I really want to get this, because that's a deep conversation I have for a long time. But I mean,
Adam, I think what you're saying is dead on. But one thing I'm slowly realizing, brother, is it requires a lot of education, because I think the perspective that Tracy was coming from is, this is my orientation, this is my way of life, mm-hmm. this is what I know. And looking at it, first look at the article, you say, well, you know, she's a bigot, or well, she's racist, or well, you know, you give her all these labels, but you dig deeper, like, wow, she really doesn't know the challenges that other neighborhoods in Baltimore face. Mm-hmm, why? Mm-hmm. Because she's not privy to them. You know, you have some black folks who aren't privy to these same challenges that lives in Baltimore City. You know, that why they live that way, why don't they go out and work, why are they so lazy? You have black folks, maybe in Park Heights, that will say the same thing. I go out and work my 9-to-5, why can't they in Sandtown, Winchester do the same thing? Mm-hmm. Because you don't understand the culture or the dynamics of it, which requires education and requires first being open to that education. And to be receptive to hearing that there are people on the other side of town who don't live like you. And a lot of us in Baltimore, it's funny, it sounds funny, but don't know that. Like, if someone go visit Patterson Park and then walk, you can literally walk down the street to McGallery Park, things start to look a little differently. And people don't realize how close we are to each other, but how different we are. But folks have to be open to the information first. And Adam, education, education, education requires that, which means educating people on the effects. But on the other hand, people got to be receptive to that education as well.
Let me come right back. Let me get Katie. You want to get these calls in here too? We have Katie, and then come back to Adam.
I was just going to say one of the things that we've done with the friends, and I'm the Hispanic liaison, so I'm, you know, that's kind of my like forte. But we've identified key Latino leaders, and we've created a Consejo Hispano, which is a Hispanic council, and we've had these women and men come together to an empowering position where they can come up with their own programs and their own events in the park, and they can create the community they want to see, as opposed to different people telling them, trying to figure out what they want and then doing it for them. Like they create this group and they're able to, you know, create the park and the community that they want to see. And I do see the neighborhood associations in the Patterson Park community trying to reach out to different members to come on board and to try to help them to create the community they want to see. And I think that model has been embraced by different organizations in the area. Like I was mentioning, the Community for All Ages group before. And I do think we need more of that. I think we need more of like the grassroots organization and community members coming together.
Let me get to the phone here so we can come back to everybody and I'll come back around the table here. Travis, you've been waiting a long time from Highland Town. You're on the air.
All right. Hi.
Hi, Travis.
Sorry, I just want to collect myself, because actually a lot of the points I wanted to make were hit, especially by Mr. Jackson and Mr. Westbrook. I do want to disagree slightly with Mr. Westbrook, and I'm sure we know each other, and I'm sure he's used to me disagreeing. I think that the piece that we're discussing that kind of kicked this off, it actually should be recognized as slightly toxic. The author, as Mr. Jackson alluded to but didn't outright say, she cherry-picked, I believe, 7 murders, and all 7 happened just by coincidence to be of white people. Mm-hmm. And she picked over a span of, I believe, 5 or 6 years in which, you know, when you're looking at a city where over 200 people are murdered a year, it's astounding that you would pick only 7 white murders, including one in 2007, in which she referred to the people who perpetrated as a pack which has troubling implications as well. She also referred to her daily routine as involving being afraid of certain children, 11-year-olds. So, there's a lot of unfortunate implications, but I think that Mr. Westbrook hit on it correctly, that this is primarily It is largely, while it is also a racial argument, I think a lot of it is a class argument. You know, she did name check ritzy restaurants, including she said she could walk to Woodbury from Patterson Park, which I find is an impressive feat. And she, she made this argument. She's been making this argument online on Twitter when asked for a follow-up. Oh, well, we should have a private police force for Butchers Hill and Canton. And this is in reference to murders that occurred in Highland Town and Patterson Park. These are, you know, not her neighborhood. So I think there's definitely a class element, and I'm going to do something I never thought I'd do, and I'm going to quote Stephanie Rollins Blake when asked about the article. She said, "I certainly hear the frustration, but if a crime happens in an area where property taxes are higher, are we supposed to care more?" And I think that kind of reflects on what to me is a large driving factor in the sentiment among certain residents that the city is not improving. And I think that's the fact that the development is all centered toward kind of ring fencing off these wealthy areas, which also happen to be white, just because, you know, there's a Venn diagram of privilege in America that goes class and race, and they kind of overlap. But I think that what you're seeing is the development attitudes of the city are to build these little islands for wealthy people who are generally white, like Harbor East and Lower Canton, and then that engenders a mentality among the residents and among other wealthy residents that, oh, well, if they have a private police force and if they have more police protection in Harbor East, well, then certainly I deserve it, too.
So let me do this. I appreciate it, Travis. I'm sorry. We only have like 5 minutes left, and I want to make sure we get
I'll jump off and listen.
All these voices to kind of close up their thoughts. There's so much else to talk about, but we have to end this like in 5 minutes. Let me just go around the room, if I might, starting with you, Adam.
Yeah, one thing I wanted to add to what you were saying, Bobby, is that I do agree that people do need education, but at the same time, I do think that, you know, white people in Baltimore particularly, they want peace and they want their nice neighborhoods, but they don't want to give up the privileges that they receive as a part of them being wealthy, living in the city, living in these nice neighborhoods, and then ignoring all the other social problems that happen to the majority working class black people that live around Baltimore. So I guess since this is our last comments, what I would offer is that the task moving forward, you know, not just dealing with crime, but with, you know, a variety of social political issues in Baltimore City, is that we have to look at the ways in which people have accumulated privilege, resources, and power, and we have to figure out ways to redistribute that power to the people that live in the communities, to the grassroots folks that work directly in those communities, so that we can transform Baltimore from the inside out. And typically those people are black. And because the majority of the city is black, and I'm not saying it as, you know, we have to only focus on race, but Baltimore is a majority black city. The majority of the people suffering are black. The majority of the people affected by crime are working class black people. So we have to figure out a way to redistribute that power from the people who have the resources, who are typically white, and give it to the people in the community who are black.
Yeah, I think that really it's important, yes, that – and the caller alluded to this a little bit, that, you know, we've been talking a lot about race in this discussion, and that's because race in Baltimore is so closely tied to crime. But I think that it is important for everyone, and this is a neighborhood, this is a city, this is just a human thing, is that there are many different types of privilege. You know, there's race, there's gender, there's sexual orientation, there's so many things, you know, that people like me who economically, like, you know, I'm a straight white middle class guy. I got the like trifecta of privilege, you know, whereas Adam, he has the privilege of being male in a male dominated society, but doesn't have the privilege of being white. Like, we all get some or less of those, but everybody has some things they have and some things they don't. And I think that it's very important for all of us to recognize and reflect on ourselves and understand what our privilege is and what we can do about it. There is something that all of us can do a little bit better. And that's not based on, you know, the quantity of what we're doing, but the motivation, the mindset of there's always a little bit to improve.
And we only have a few minutes left. I do want to get everybody in here. So talking about male privilege, Katie Long.
Oh. Thanks. No, I guess, and this is probably like a superficial idealistic comment, but like I said, I just hope out of all of this, we can not shut ourselves in and be afraid of each other, but like really strive to go out and trust each other more, play together more in the park, and that Baltimore and, you know, that community is for everyone, and everyone has the right to live in a safe and healthy community.
Hosday.
Well, I'd like to thank Travis for his comments. I know he's a passionate advocate for Baltimore. And I agree that there are many things in the article that I found offensive that got my hackles up. I think, though, that when you say that someone's viewpoint is toxic, that has a tendency to shut down debate. And I don't think that's positive. I think that Tracy Alveson represents a very significant point of view in the city which needs to be taken into account. And I think that we need less condemnation and more conversation, because we need both the Tracy Alvesons and the people that she seems to want to have disappear.
Close us out, Bobby Marvin Holmes.
Racism, classism, sexism is all rooted in one thing, that's ignorance. And this conversation points to Baltimore's ignorance and the need for folks to come out of their shell, come out of their privilege, and connect with other folks, because it's going to require for Baltimoreans to stand up and take responsibility. That's the only way we're going to change this.
So Shaka Zulu, Linda Kellogg's, I'm sorry we couldn't get to all these calls. We'll have these panels and panels like this coming back more often. I think this is an important conversation for us to have, more important sometimes than talking about some of the other things we do talk about. And we will reconvene this panel. I do want to thank everybody for being here. Tim Barnett, great to have you here and meet you. And Hosday Westbrook, same here. Good to have you in the studio. Katie Long, by Marv Holmes, thank you for coming in. And Adam Jackson,
always a pleasure.
Good to see you.
Thank you.
And we'll continue this. This is a very important conversation. We'll have everybody who's written these blogs, we're going to have what they've written at steinershow.org, so you can see it all and how this conversation came to us. We didn't get to half the things I wanted to get to in this conversation. We're about to come back sometime in the next week to see if we can get these folks back on here to wrestle with this some more in a longer session with all of you, since so many of you out there also want to talk about it. We can see that from the calls coming in, the tweets coming in. We are taking a break. We're going to go out with Hot Pants, James Brown, and why? Well, because our next guest is coming up to talk about a really critical social phenomenon in America. We don't think about it as that way, which is Soul Train. And Dr. Erica Blount-Danwal wrote the book Love, Peace, and Soul, behind the scenes of America's favorite show, Soul Train, coming right up. Stay with us. Move.